Talk given Sunday, 8th April 1979. We all know that the universal process is characterized by constant change. Now, this change, as we see it around us and in our own lives, may be fortuitous, useless, haphazard, or it may be a regressive change. And if it is sufficiently regressive, it could be harmful, it could be destructive. We have only to read history, we have only to look around us in our world today to see that that is the case. But if that change is truly a progressive change, then we could be moving towards our true fruition and fulfillment. Now, the most powerful factors which influence this change are, first and foremost, consciousness, our topic for today. Next, our needs, bodily, psychological, and I won't use the word spiritual by itself, but psycho-spiritual. I'm not using the word spiritual because in its deep sense, the spiritual is not a need. It is an absolute fact, and it is characterless. It is power which we cannot know with our brains. But there is a thing like our psycho-spiritual needs. So we'll try and approach our whole topic from these aspects. As we know, there are constructive influences in our lives. Good health, good upbringing, which implies good parents, and they are a little bit difficult to find. This is one of the sad things in the history of the human race so far. Good education, which means good teachers, another difficult thing to find. And it means good companions. Concerning ourselves, it means good sense, intelligence. Then there are destructive influences, and I'm afraid that they are legion. First and foremost, there is ignorance, in where our own ignorance of the fact that we are ignorant is the most troublesome factor. The whole human race, or at least the majority of people constituting the human race, will not be prepared to admit that it is ignorant. But this is the first and fundamental fact of our actual state. And it is only the person who has become the full-fledged, true human, that is the person who, having fully realized his ignorance as such, has become enlightened. By fully realizing any defect, the transcendent virtue corresponding to that defect is present. Because every virtue in its transcendent state has successfully integrated the dualistic good-evil cruelty, kindness, etc., etc., which functions in our ordinary, ambivalent, psychical life. Then, of course, there are wrong desires and impulses, self-centeredness and self-indulgence, evil motives and the ordinary vices as we know them, ill-breeding, wrong companions, and the sheer misfortune of deprivation and disease, bodily and mental. There is the destructive influence of parental stupidity and neglect, of brutalization by circumstances or by oppression. Worst of all, there is the lack of vision, the vision of the purpose of our existence, the vision of the way we could cooperate with the trends of life. And the trends of life are invincible. If we fail to see them, and if we fail to cooperate with them, then life just wipes us out. And that's that. Now, if and when we do have vision, and we can see which elements in the process of change are in harmony with the trends of life, then it is our responsibility to cooperate with them. That is our personal responsibility, our actual task. Now, a few words in connection with our needs. Everyone knows what our real needs are, our fundamental, basic needs. Bodily, food, warmth, and shelter. These are concrete. They are particular and finite. Then there are our psychological needs. Happiness, security, love, peace of mind, a congenial job, some degree of success, and social acceptance. Now, the psychological needs play a central part in our life because we are essentially psychophysical beings. And it is mind in us which preeminently distinguishes us from all other living creatures, on this planet at least. So our psychological needs become very important. But note very carefully, an interesting point with regard to physical bodily needs and psychological needs. Our bodily needs, we can measure. This much food is enough, this is the right sort of food for me, this much warmth is enough, and we can just be sensible and live reasonably well and healthily, physically. Here, measurement comes into play. Because the bodily needs are finite. They are measurable. Now, what do we do with respect to our psychological needs? We don't say, oh, that's that much happiness I want, this much love, and so forth. The terms we use are complete security, perfect success, eternal love, everlasting happiness. Now, this is a very important point because our physical existence is concerned, we are content to be sensible in relation to what we may call, in physical terms, quantity. But where the psychological needs are concerned, we are reaching out towards the infinite, the eternal, the immortal. But these words are descriptive of the context of transcendence itself. We are not quite aware of that. You see? Now, if we wake up to that fact, then we shall begin to see that the progressive change that we really long for, and which our psychological needs, we long for them, an intense desire for them. Where our psychological needs are concerned, there is this movement towards the transcendent, the complete, the perfect, the eternal, the infinite, and so forth. It's a movement out of the bounds and limitations imposed upon us in our physical life, and the manner in which we are aware of the physical world around us. So there is this strange power inside us, this embodied, silent, quiet divinity within us, which, without exercising any compulsion, is somehow like a magnet drawing us towards itself all the time. And this is something very important. The psyche is the link between our mortal bodily existence. The body will of necessity absolutely die, but the psyche, being the link between that which is finite and mortal and that which is infinite and immortal, must play its proper part in order that the human being living here in the world does emerge, grow into his true fruition and fulfillment. Now, what is the actual fact in our lives? Psychologically, we have some degree of happiness, of love, of security, and so on, some peace of mind, and we also have the opposite. We have the mixture of the two. Our psyche lives in this ambivalent state. What is good and what is evil? And it vacillates between the two. And it causes a conflict. And it causes a conflict in the beginning in an unintelligent way. We think in terms of getting rid of destroying that which is unpleasant, that which we don't like, which causes us discomfort or pain. But we never think in terms of learning our lesson from that. And our attitude towards the pleasant, towards what is agreeable and acceptable, is one of greed. We start conscious of greed, not so much conscious, I should say, as unconscious of the fact that greed is the driving force behind our longing for happiness and love and so forth. It is only when we begin to pay attention to deprivation of these things to the unpleasant side and learn our lesson from it, then we begin to understand how the life force works through body and psyche, through the unit which is the psychophysical organism as such. So our psychological needs help, provided we approach them in the right way, help us to understand the trends of life in us and how to cooperate with them and to bring about progressive change. So, through our psychological needs, realizing that we have only a part, but we long for the whole, we become aware, even if dimly, of a strong desire to go beyond the bounds of the limited and finite towards the infinite and the eternal, to move out of the imperfect and incomplete towards the perfect and the complete. So, although we now experience life and we are conscious of our world in terms of duality and conflict, like a seesaw of opposites, our basic urge is towards being conscious in terms of wholeness and harmony. Now, we become conscious of the urge in the true sense only when we wake up to what is actually taking place within us all the time. But if we don't wake up, we don't become conscious of this urge, although the urge is there. And do remember that this urge, which is the power of transcendence within us at work, does not compel. It is non-compulsive. At this point, we might as well ask ourselves, in what manner are we conscious of our world? If we discover that, we discover the fundamental source of the conflict, the turmoil, the disharmony within us. We are conscious of all objects as separate objects, distinct, separate objects. We are conscious of people as so many different people. Some of us are reasonably conscious of the interrelationships between all objects and between all people. But it would be very hard to find anybody who is really awake, really conscious of the complete interrelationship and interaction between all objects and all people in the world. Because if that consciousness is there, fully developed, fully functioning, then that person is one of the great spiritual, religious teachers of mankind. He is the one who, by virtue of being what he is, saves, that is, salves, heals all mankind, because consciousness in this full transcendent sense is not something specific to me, like my arm is specific to me or my psyche, my psychical processes are specific to me. It is something which is absolutely universal. Consciousness is not my property. I might as well claim proprietorship over God or a little bit of God or the transcendent or whatever you like to call it. Think of it somewhat like this. Space. It's our most marvelous teacher. Do I possess any bit of space? Can I seize hold of a bit of space, label it and say, Firoz Mehta space, don't touch, danger? It's impossible, because it is of a transcendental nature. It is all-inclusive. It is not merely outside me, it is not merely inside me. Whether this object, this person here, exists or not, space completely interpenetrates everything. Now, the transcendent context is of that nature. Infinite, non-being in the sense of separate being, immeasurable, incomprehensible by any brain and sense functioning process. See, that is its nature. And consciousness is of this nature, in the religious sense. That is why the old teachers identified the supreme, the ultimate, the absolute, whatever it was, with pure, absolute consciousness. Now you see the implication of that. What is the meaning, therefore, of becoming truly conscious of anything? In simple words, as far as I can present them, when you are really conscious of something, you can do that something, you can be that something, without having to think about it, without having to remember it. Bring it up to mind if you have failed to remember it or think it. It just functions naturally, absolutely naturally and spontaneously. If one is conscious of love or wisdom or goodness or truth or beauty in the real sense, then one's whole life in limited terms, our limited terms of thought and feeling, of speech and action, is love in manifestation. And this brain here, one's own brain, is quite unaware of it. When this realization has come to fruition, then you are unconscious as a separate individual of that fruition and that realization. The one who has become, as we say, become one with the divine, doesn't know it anymore with the brain. He doesn't need to know it with the brain. And the brain can never know it in the sense in which the brain knows things. If you look into the way in which our brain knows things, you will see that it knows them by virtue of separation, of distinction. And if that separation, which means finitude and mortality and so forth, is not there, then the brain doesn't know it. But there is this divine knowing, this unknowing knowing, which is the knowing of the spirit, the absolute, the totality. The totality just is. It doesn't know I am the totality. It doesn't measure. It can't measure. Infinity is infinity. There is no measure there. And so forth. Now, consciousness in the religious sense means that. But this consciousness, to come to fruition within us, has of necessity to start at the beginning. And the beginning is the state which is the unawakened state. It is there in us. Divinity is embodied in us as our supreme potentiality. And it is simply because through the ages there have been those wonderful men and women who, having come to full flowering in terms of true humanity, the true sons and daughters of man, which means the son or daughter of mind, of supreme mind, which is the divine mind itself. It is they who have realized this sort of thing and taught those who cared to learn. They never imposed themselves. They said, come to me, I'll give you a 6 months course to go into nirvana. Perhaps it may take you a week extra because you are not sufficiently developed at the moment. You see, it's not like that. But those people knew. But their very presence was such an inspiration. A quiet, deeply silent, and therefore most eloquent source of inspiration for those who really cared for the one and only worthwhile thing to care for. And that is truth, the reality. What am I here for? And so forth. Now, the root source of our trouble then is this consciousness as it is at the moment, this slowly growing consciousness. At the moment, we are conscious in terms of self and not self. And one can never repeat this too often. Call up in your own mind how vividly conscious we are of ourselves. This is myself. And all the rest of the universe is the not-self. A slight disproportion where importance is concerned, isn't it? Oh, well, that's the not-self. That's something else. It is this unfortunate diseased awareness of a not-self, separate from myself, which is the root source of all the conflict on all planes of our being. Self, not-self. Therefore, one has self-interest. And therefore, the clever people, particularly politicians, talk about enlightened self-interest. Sometimes one could wish that it would really light up and blaze away and be burnt, completely wiped out. Enlightened self-interest. A self-contradictory statement. What enlightenment can there be if one has separate interests which are in conflict with my neighbor's interests? Then we talk very piously about loving one's neighbor as oneself, which means doing or trying to do this and that other good for his sake. It is all for your own good, which means that we are satisfying our power lust to impose our ideas and our beliefs and our ways of life upon them, not leaving them free to grow. One can help. That is a right way of helping. Simile comes up in my mind. At the dinner table, you see that somebody is looking for the salt. You just put it there, don't you? You don't say, take this salt, you've got to take it. But that is just exactly what the do-gooders do. the very deliberate do-gooders. The natural do-gooders, well, they can't help it. They were made that way. The great artists and so forth, they couldn't help it. When you are really loving something, really totally in love with something, it all happens naturally and rightly. But it has to be a total loving. And what is these? Perhaps one of the supreme characteristics of that. There is no separate selfness, and above all, the consciousness of separate selfness involved in that total loving. When that consciousness of separate selfness is completely out, then you can't help but totally love. There is no option at all. It is the transcendent state, that integrated state where the ambivalence of love-hate is non-existent. The psyche, in other words, has become utterly purified of all hate, of all violence, of all jealousy, of all personal ambitions which imply harming one's neighbor. Now, it is important for us to try to understand the real nature of the context of transcendence and the implications thereof in our own daily lives. We use these words so easily, infinity, immortality, and clever ones try to put specific meanings, dictionary meanings, in the language of the finite and the mortal. Well, you can't do it. There is no real language. Language consists of words which are but symbolical sounds to represent the real thing. To represent, that is all. It's like a still photograph of a live person. We know that the still photograph is not the live person. But in this sphere, we do not know that we are mistaking that which is a fossil for the living reality. And it is important, if religious living means anything to us, to try to understand this and become inwardly aware of it. Not know it merely intellectually, that is superficially, merely in terms of so many words which may give us a nice feeling, but in terms of the actual fact. When that actual fact is there, the truth is there. Now, there are times when we have the experience of that which is the unitary whole, which is the harmony of the whole. We actually become conscious, truly conscious, for a while at least, of this great unity of the universe. And it is this experiencing, which happens so often in nature, which happens through meditation, which is true meditation, or prayer, which is the real contemplative prayer, or it just is given unto us through grace. Grace is everlastingly present, and we could awaken to it. But because we are not awake to it, we hinder grace from functioning through us. That is why we don't experience what is commonly called in theistic terms the grace of God. We challenge it, we question it, we don't believe in it, and so forth. But who's preventing grace from functioning? I myself. That is all. Grace is perfectly matter of fact. The transcendent, in every aspect of its transcendence, is perfectly matter of fact. As matter of fact, in terms of totality and universality, as the furniture in your room or the mechanisms for transport and so forth are just matter of fact things. This is the matter of fact reality. And this is something towards which human consciousness is growing. Man's destiny, then, is the divine itself. That is man's destiny. But since it is the divine itself, since it is transcendence, the totality, one cannot seek it for oneself or in terms of the activities and procedures thought out and generated by oneself, because I, the particular self, am limited, am ignorant, am imperfect. But if I see my limitations, if I really see them, my imperfections, my ignorance, then that seeing brings to life the sense of transcendence which is there, dormant within my very being. Then I cease to strive, and the ultimate reality, the supreme God, use any word you like, the transcendent takes charge. That is to say, is allowed to take charge. You see, transcendence doesn't compel. I can say nay to transcendence. That takes charge and brings to fruition the manifestation of perfect manhood through the finite, the mortal, individual man. What an extraordinary destiny. That's just one way of looking at it. There are so many ways. But you see, if any one way strikes home, and we can really thrill to it and respond to it rightly, and become free of this poison of separate selfness, then the right things happen. But we mustn't try to define the right things, because if we try to define it, functioning as we do through our senses and the brain, which is a very limited thing, we shall always misdefine it, wrongly define it, we'll limit it. There we just put up a notice to transcendence, don't enter. Therefore, whatsoever comes to us in this awakened state, we can accept, absorb within our own psyche. And if the mind is quite open, quite ready to take anything and everything that comes, to see it intelligently and truly for what it is, then whether it is good or whether it is evil, in ambivalent terms, in our worldly state, both of those, the good and the evil as such, are transmuted into the absolute good, which is of a transcendent dimension. It is of the nature of the eternal, the immortal. And in that process, And in that state, you, the person, are actually experiencing immortality, not knowing that you are experiencing immortality. Not knowing with the brain. The self-consciousness is out. No separate self-conscious creature can ever become immortal as such, because we misdefine it. We think of immortality as the opposite of mortality. What we commonly see as the phenomenon of the death of an organism is the opposite of birth. You have the birth and the procedure of that organism through life, and then the ending of that particular organism. This is what we see. But immortality is not the opposite of this. When consciousness has really come to its great fruition and freed itself from awareness in separate terms, then the simultaneity of the life-death pulse of creation is present in consciousness. It is a simultaneous thing. Why has it got to be a simultaneous thing? Because when creation is going on, constant change is going on. But every change in every split second of existence means that the old state has become the new state, which means that the old state has, in our more ordinary terms, died in order that the new may be there. But you see, that sort of continuity is not a continuity through time or even through timelessness. Both time and timelessness are completely subsumed in the reality which is eternity. These are difficult things. They are really difficult things. But they can be realized. And so, if we can, through our own living experience, and particularly if we are quiet and calm, still and silent within ourselves, this realization can take place. And when this realization takes place, there is the fulfillment of transcendence as perfect manhood through oneself, the finite mortal man. And then the reality of consciousness is everlastingly there.